Hello, I'm Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, economist Ralph Shammy explains how money migrants send home to their family can have a negative impact on growth.
Really, the big question has been in remittances how to take money that's meant to insure people against shocks and make it a source of capital for development.
Few would argue that workers' remittances, the money migrants send to their family in their home country, improved the lives of millions of people. Remittances amounted to over $400 billion last year. That's somewhere between official development assistance and foreign direct investment in terms of size. These massive financial flows have important consequences for the economies that receive them. But in this podcast, IMF economist Ralph Shammy says while the benefits of remittances may look good from afar, the real macroeconomic impact, as it stands, is far from good. Shammy is co-author of an article entitled Is There a Remittance Trap? Featured in the September 2018 edition of Finance and Development magazine. So many have argued that remittances do help economies grow, but your article suggests that's not necessarily the case. Have economists, you think, been painting too rosy a picture of the impact of remittances?
The quick answer is yes. Some, because others, such as myself and other researchers, have actually been working on this for a long time, and we see no evidence that remittances enhance growth. They do wonderful things, but growth is not one of them. Mm. I think the confusion arises that remittances alleviate poverty, provide buffers against the shocks to consumption. They're very good at basically helping people out in tough times, especially after disasters, after crises. But they're not the manna from heaven. They're not also a source of capital for development.
But it seems fairly straightforward. I mean, the recipients have more money in their pocket. They spend more.
Yes.
There's more demand for goods, all that good stuff that we associate with growing economies.
Absolutely.
So what's the problem?
Absolutely. It's when you aggregate it. Mm. You get the effects, some not so great effects of, for example, that's true that people have more money in their pockets and they purchase products with it, but they also purchase leisure with it. So they could opt out of the labor market, or in other words, you have to pay them more in order for them to work. So that raises the reservation wage.
But what you're describing there is perhaps what unemployment insurance might do. In terms of what it would take to get somebody to actively look for a job.
Precisely, because people value leisure over labor. Mm-hmm. And so when they get unearned income, in addition to their income, they now have more choices. Mm-hmm. And one viable choice is to actually work less. You have now the time, the space to actually opt out. That's one aspect of it. So what happens if I just follow your logic, then what happens is the wage, we call it reservation wage, the wage at which I'm willing to actually work goes up. Mm. And that raises the prices because that's wages are a cost to production. So the cost of production goes up. As a result, the prices go up. So yes, the demand goes up because now I have more money. So that also bids up the prices. So it takes more now to get people to work, and it costs more to consume the same product that you actually would have consumed before had you not been receiving those remittances, if you like.
There is a political dimension to this story as well. You suggest governments may not be overly motivated to address the issues that can lead to this so-called remittance trap. Why this complacency on the part of some politicians?
So what happens is we find, and this is in work that we had done before, is people that receive remittances, countries that actually depend quite heavily on remittances, the more you insure me or you buffer me against the shock, the less I'm careful about trying to avoid the shock.
Oh.
And so you find that people actually are less demanding of their governments.
Hmm.
Because why? What do I care what the government is doing if somebody's giving me money from abroad? So I may be aware that the government may be doing stuff that I don't really like, but do I really care? As long as the government does not tax their remittances, and no government taxes remittances. So you get this money in, and people say, well, Okay, so I'm insured. So even I'm insured against disasters to a certain extent. I'm not fully insured, but I'm also insured against stupidity of the government or government mistakes. So that's called the moral hazard in economics. But it's actually a double-edged moral hazard because now the government knows that I'm actually getting money from abroad. So what is the incentive for the government to provide the public good? For example, in countries that receive remittances, what you find is people use remittances to purchase education, private education, private medical assistance. So now the government says, so why should I provide you public education or decent medical services? I know that you have the money to purchase it. So what's happened is that relationship between the citizens and the government weakens. You're not holding the government accountable. So it's a double-edged moral hazard. In fact, we find evidence, and now others, we were the first to actually point that out. We have an article called Our Remittance is a Curse on remittance institutions. People have actually found it in many other contexts that by insuring people in this form, governance weakens. And of course, we know that governance affects growth. So you're telling me, well, the demand goes up, so that helps consumption. Consumption leads to growth. Yes, perhaps. But on the other hand, governance weakens, and that also negatively affects growth. Another channel, if you like, I can use those remittances to get educated. But I would get educated because that's my ticket out of the country.
So the people are generally better educated in countries that have higher remittances, but it doesn't necessarily translate into a reinvestment, like in terms of perhaps small businesses or entrepreneurship.
Exactly.
So these countries don't benefit from that.
Exactly, because you could actually start. But in order for an entrepreneurship to succeed, it's not only just the seed money. You have to have the enabling environment. So if governance is weak and the government is not doing what it's supposed to be doing, so now you have the money to start a business, but you may not succeed because the enabling environment is not there. And that also already gives you a clue as to the solution to these things. Hmm. How do you take that money and turn it into development money? So the big question has been in remittances, how to take money that's meant to insure people against shocks and make it a source of capital for development. Hmm. People have confused that warm glow feeling about remittances. They think it's the answer to everything. And I've been telling people, if it is the answer to everything, then it's an optimal policy for governments to kick out all of its young people.
So in a sense, it's developing its human capital,
yes.
But preparing it to immigrate.
Yes, in many countries, that's what we see, is that human capital is not used within. And that's the question should be, why is it not?
Okay. So you use Lebanon as an example of a country that can fall or has fallen victim to what you're describing.
Yes.
You coined the term the remittance trap.
Yes.
And Lebanon is, in fact, very dependent on remittances. I think 16% of GDP is what you quote in the article.
Yes, minimum. And that's a minimum.
Hmm. So what could people have done or what can people do with this money that they're receiving that might have a more positive and lasting effect on the economy of Lebanon?
So it's not the people that receive it. They're using it rightly in the way that they were supposed to use it. The remittance trap idea, some people have actually worked on this and said, you know, when a country discovers natural resources, that's where the phrase Dutch disease comes from, right? The simplest way to explain the Dutch disease without boring the audience is to say, if you have too many dollars coming into your economy, could be from you discovered, you know, oil wells and now you're selling oil, or as the Dutch discovered the natural gas fields in Groningen. And so what happens is they had an inflow of dollars. So what happens, anything that you oversupply, its price goes down.
I see.
Relative to your currency. So what happened in Holland is that the dollar price dropped because they were selling, you know, all this gas and they got abundance of dollars. And as a result, their currency appreciated. When your currency appreciates, that means your product that you're trying to sell abroad becomes expensive. So what happened? It has a negative impact on the manufacturing side in Holland. And thus the coined phrase of Dutch disease. Now, So you could actually have the same argument with the remittances, if you like. And people have done it in terms of, you know, do FDIs cause something like that? Does ODA, does aid lead to Dutch disease effects? Do remittances lead to Dutch disease effects? And these are price effects. So because you have so much supply of dollars coming in, your currency appreciates because the dollar becomes cheaper, and that hurts your export sector. With remittances, there's much more to it, because it's coming into people's pockets. And as you told me, yes, they spend more because now they have, but their reservation wages goes up more. And they choose to participate less in the labor force. So as a result, it's like Dutch disease on steroids. Huh. All right. Now, what happens in the Dutch disease story is the manufacturing sector, or the export sector, if you like, gets starved out because the other sector is growing. The non-traded sector grows at its expense. In the case of remittances, it's even more so, because people are choosing to work less, or you have to pay them more for them to actually engage in the labor market. And at the same time, their consumption is going up of services, which we refer to them as non-traded goods. As a result, the manufacturing sector is shrinking. When you put the two together, growth suffers. When you add to it especially the governance issues and other unsavory effects at the macro level. So when you say, well, what people should do, well, people are doing what makes them happy. And I wouldn't change that. But what we're looking at is the macro impact of it.
So you know, given the scale of remittances,
yes.
$406 billion in 2017 alone, what is to be done in order to not squander what seems a perfectly good opportunity for governments?
And it is indeed, and I'd like to reemphasize this, is remittances are to be encouraged because, again, in countries where you don't have formal insurance markets, they are the insurance for the poor. They are the insurance for the people. But it's, again, it's at the macro level. So what do we do? How can we, you know, reduce the negative externalities, if you like, or the negative effect of remittances? And it, when you look at it, and you know, kind of dissect it, you realize that one of the best ways of doing it is the government, or there's a role for, the, if you like, for the IMF, the World Bank, and in encouraging governments to invest in infrastructure. Now, you may say, why? Because if you believe our story of the remittance trap, the manufacturing sector is suffering. And it's suffering, it's losing its competitiveness because of the other sector, the non-traded sector, is siphoning off all the resources. So how do you help the manufacturing sector? By actually increasing its productivity. And how do you increase productivity without skewing the incentives? Is by the government investing in infrastructure. So our advice would be that we should actually encourage governments to invest in infrastructure to help the manufacturing. And when you invest in infrastructure, you're actually helping all of these, the manufacturing and the other kinds of you know, goods production, be it services, be it others, everybody benefits from it. So it's neutral in that respect, but it raises the productivity of the manufacturing sector, allows it to breathe, allows it to be able to compete. At the same time, because we talked about the governance issues, you know, the IMF has an agenda on inclusive growth. Turns out that actually it's even more immediate in countries with remittances. Because what is the inclusive growth agenda? It's about reforming and helping reforming the regulatory structure, mm-hmm. allowing businesses to thrive, allowing the private sector.
Better business environment.
Absolutely, because if you have seed money from your cousin or your family, how will you be able to use it in an environment where there are no rules, or if there are rules, they're not being followed? And so the turns out that the recipe for, you know, growth being inclusive is the same recipe that would apply in the case of the remittance trap, except that it's even more immediate. So remittances are good at the individual level, for sure. They do wonderful things. They insure you against poverty, against shocks. You can buy education, all this stuff. It's when you aggregate it at the macro level, it's a different story. And this is where there's a role for public policy.
Ralph Shamy is an assistant director in the IMF's Institute for Capacity Development and co-author of Is There a Remittance Trap? Featured in the September 2018 edition of Finance and Development magazine. You can find the magazine at imf.org/FND or download the Finance and Development app to read it on your mobile device. And if you like this podcast, subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.